Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN 720. We're going to spend the next hour celebrating Paramount Records. The Paramount Records up in Wisconsin, started by the Wisconsin Chair Company in 1917. It's their 100th anniversary. That was Prison Blues, I believe, by Alice Moore. Is that right? Anyway, it's for our incarcerated listeners out there. So we're going to start. We've got a lot going on. We're going to have some live music in a minute, but we're going to start with Chris Raymond. Thank you for coming down from the Grafton area.
Yes.
And you're going to talk a little bit. I want you to set everything up about the anniversary celebration, September 1st to 3rd, up there in
Port Washington.
Port Washington. Tell us exactly where. I've been there, but where's Port Washington?
Port Washington is right on Lake Michigan, approximately 25 minutes straight north of Milwaukee.
And so, yeah, it's close enough. So tell me what's
close.
Yeah. So tell me what's going to be going on. And give me a handicap the festival.
Okay. Well, this is the 12th annual Paramount Music Festival, but it is the centennial celebration of Paramount Records, which was started by the Wisconsin Chair Factory in the Wisconsin Chair Company in Port Washington, Wisconsin. The recordings were actually done in Grafton, which is right next door. So both cities share the history. We've got three
Grafton's
days.
About 10 miles, maybe?
Oh, from Port? I don't even think it's that far.
Okay,
yeah. I don't know. I live there, so it's all just...
Okay, so go ahead.
We've got a three-day festival, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, Labor Day weekend. We've got music from 4 to 10 on Friday and noon to 10 both days, Saturday and Sunday.
Some of the headliners, I mean, you got our friend Billy Branch.
Oh, yeah. Saturday night is the Chicago Legends celebrate Paramount Records with Billy Branch and the Sons of Blues. John Primer, Corky Siegel, Sam Lake.
Sam Lake,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Eddie the Chief Clearwater. It's going to be quite an evening for sure. And right before that, we have Shamika Copeland.
That's at 6:45
yes.
on Saturday.
Yes,
Saturday. And what's the venue? Where do they play at?
The park is called Coal Dock Park in Port. It used to actually be a coal dock right on Lake Michigan. So when you're at the festival, you're literally on Lake Michigan looking back into the city. It's beautiful.
And keep going on Sunday.
Sunday, we have our headliner is a rock band called Star Set. Sunday is what we call our eclectic day. So we have blues on every day. Our blues band on Sunday would be Reverend Raven and the Chainsmokin' Altar Boys with West Side Andy.
Boy.
We also have the Muddy Crows out of D.C. and Nelson Street Revival out of Chicago.
You have some of our friends. We know Ellen Miller and Kathy Richardson. What,
yes.
What's the setup with that?
Well, they've got Kathy, Ellen, Ann Harris, and Peaches. The Nelson Street Revival. I'm really looking forward to that set. That's going to be fun.
And so, how does the festival relate with the label and stuff? Is there progress? Is there stuff going on to get markers up? I know there's some markers and show people where the sites were
yes.
and things like that.
Yes. In 2008, we put a marker in Grafton. This year, we're dedicating another Blues Trail marker in Port Washington, and that'll be done on Saturday afternoon. The Mississippi Tourism Council will be in town. So when we started to support the story. I was brought into the story. I'm an Elgin girl.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So I was brought into the story, and the first time I heard it, I thought, I couldn't believe that it wasn't, you know, being celebrated. And the more research I did, the more I realized what an unbelievable story it really is for these small towns. So we started a Blues Association, the Grafton Blues Association.
When did that start?
2006.
Okay.
We decided we wanted to do a festival. This little idea quickly escalated into a worldwide. We started getting emails from around the world basically saying, it's about time you did something out there. So here we are, 12 years later, centennial anniversary. This year we got a $30,000 marketing grant from the state of Wisconsin, which is really helping us reach about 7 million people this year.
Where do people come from?
All over.
All over.
I think our furthest ticket purchase so far has been from Italy.
Italy,
mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, what is the whole, and we'll get into this with Gail in the next segment, but what is the whole Jack White thing? And people might know about this huge, I can't afford it, but this huge Jack White box. What's like 800 songs
yes.
that kind of cover the whole, I mean, it was blues and jazz, but there was also, I know about some of the blues and jazz, but there was also hillbilly. And
oh, they did country. They even did some of the local high school marching bands were recorded through Grafton and Paramount. Jack did I think you're right, 800.
Yeah.
800 songs. And I think he's got another volume getting
ready
to come out.
Yeah,
right, yeah. I've been working on getting Jack to come to Port Washington. Jack, if you're listening.
I'm sure he is. is he? I mean, does he know what's going on up there?
And
has he been up to the area?
I believe so, yes. Yes.
No, I went up there. I can't remember. It was like 2007, 2008. I don't know. I told you they had the restaurant. It's no longer there, called the Paramount. But tell us some of the stories about they were right on the river. I remember one story that really resonated with me is that, and I think maybe the History Channel or something did something. Sometimes they would throw records. The label went from 1917 to 1932, something like that, right?
Well, the stories.
They would throw stuff in the river.
Oh, yeah.
They
weren't happy when the plant shut down. It's really not a happy story for the families that, you know, lived through this, obviously. But yes, they did. They threw the records into the river when the plant closed down.
78.
They were quite angry. And the history detectives actually came to Grafton and did a story. They didn't find any long-lost blues treasures, but they're probably still there somewhere.
If our listeners want to drive up there, how many sites remain? How many? I mean, somebody took me somewhere. Maybe it's just an abandoned building or something. Is there anything physical that people can see?
Grafton has a walking tour. There is some, I guess, remains of where the studio and the old chair factory stood, but not much. There's a marker that the city put up. There's the Blues Trail marker that we put up. If you go through Grafton into downtown, they have what's called the Paramount Plaza, and there's a giant keyboard celebrating all the Black Keys are celebrating the artists that recorded for Paramount in Grafton. So it's kind of interesting to go and see all of that. But as far as buildings and whatnot, there's some houses that, you know, they can show you who was doing what at that time. Same with Port Washington. The chair company burned down, so there's really nothing left of that. But where we have the festival is right across from where the chair factory stood. So people can actually, where the Blues Trail marker will go is where the chair factory stood.
During segregation, and we talked about this on one of my visits up there, where did artists like Ma Rainey and I think it was Ubi Blake, where did they stay?
Well, I know Ma Rainey stayed in a residence. In 2006, we brought up Henry Townsend from St. Louis. He was the last living bluesman that recorded in Grafton.
Uh-huh.
So we brought him up for the festival. We wined and dined him from Thursday till Saturday when he fell ill. And one of the questions I asked him was if he stayed in what is now known as the Grafton Hotel. And he said, no, we weren't allowed in there. We had to stay in this building across the street and sometimes in the basement because they weren't allowed. And it really opened my eyes to how things really were back then. Unfortunately, when he was there with us, he passed away while he was up for the festival.
Oh, he's up for the festival. I do remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
he was a remarkable man. He really was. So we've grown quite close with his son, Alonzo, and we're family now.
What have you learned from talking? How long have you been working on this project?
I started the association and the festival in 2006. I've learned a lot.
Like such as?
Well, like what we just talked about, I didn't grow up with that kind of discrimination. I really didn't.
Yeah.
And just hearing some of these guys' stories, like Honey Boy Edwards, some of the stories that man could tell. I remember at one festival walking into a room full of grown men, and they were all on the edge of their chairs listening to Honey Boy talk. Nobody was talking or asking questions. It was just letting him talk. And these guys, they could remember, you know, 50 years ago like it was yesterday.
We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with historian Gail Dean Wardlow on the phone. And then we're going to have some live music in the studio from Kathy Greer. So don't go away on WGN's Nocturnal Journal.
My mother told me just before she died. 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 Oh, daughter, daughter, please don't be like me. Oh, daughter, daughter, please don't be like me. Oh, daughter, daughter, please don't be like me. To fall in love with every man you see. But I did not listen what my mother said. No, I did not listen what my mother said. No, I did not listen what my mother said. And that's the reason why I'm sitting in here today. Baby, now she's dead and 6 feet underground. Now she's dead and 6 feet underground. Now she's dead and 6 feet underground. I'm a child, I've been drifting around.
Welcome back. That's awesome to Nocturnal Journal on WGN as we celebrate 100 years of the Paramount record label. That's Kathy Greer. You won People's Choice in the Paramount Music Association's People's Choice for the International Blues Challenge. So thanks. And you live in Sturgeon Bay?
I do now.
So thanks for coming down. We're going to bring on historian Gail Dean Wardlow in a minute, but tell us what that song was before we bring Gail.
That's Motherless Child by Elfie Thomas and Gishi Wiley.
And they were Paramount.
Paramount musicians, very obscure song. There's only like one copy.
And how'd you find it?
I found it by digging around on the internet, and a good old friend of mine back in high school in Connecticut, Don Hubbard, looked it up on Facebook, and he said, you need to check out this song.
You didn't find it in the Milwaukee River?
No, I didn't find it. I would have loved to look.
You'd be rich. Right? Gail, you there?
Dave, I've been listening to the show since 9 o'clock.
Oh, have you? Really?
Yes, talking about, in other words, vinyl records. And I wanted to say, you know, Paramount's were what we call 78 records.
Yeah, that's right. You, thanks for joining us tonight. You're in Pensacola, right?
I'm in Pensacola, and I've got a Paramount 78 record in front of me. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize that it's a 78 record. They stopped making them in 1960, but they had one song to each side, and they played at 78 RPMs, and that was what Paramount Records were played at.
You're the author of Chasing That Devil Music, Searching for the Blues. That came out in 1998.
Right.
And you have one of the world's largest collections of pre-war blues records, right?
Well, mostly, yeah. I still have most of them, including about almost, I've had as many as 300 Paramounts in my collection.
That's what I was going to ask. How big is your collection?
It's still about 900 records, and, you know, I have Choice Paramounts, and Paramount's the most collectible label of all your pre-World War II labels, especially those out of the 1920s,
yeah.
Early 30s.
So for novice listeners, I mean, talk about where Paramount fits in, why it's most collectible, Charlie Patton, talk about some of the people that recorded there.
Well, I'll tell you this, and quickly, I'll say, she was talking about Elvie Thomas.
Yeah.
Actually, Elvie Thomas and Gishi Wiley came from the Houston, Texas area, and they found Elvie Thomas and some pictures of her, and they ran a story in the New York Times on her. But she was picked up by Paramount, by a talent scout, and taken to Grafton, Wisconsin to record in 1930. And, you know, basically, here's the situation. You had major record companies in the 20s, Columbia and Victor and Brunswick, that, you know, on the record market, and Paramount actually went in the business of making Victrolas. They were a woodworking company, Wisconsin Chair Company. They got in the Victrola business, and they found out, well, we've got to have some records to give away when someone buys our Victrola. So then they decided, well, maybe we'll start making our own records. So they started, they trademarked the Paramount label like October 1917, and the first Paramount come out in November of 17, so actually that's your 100th anniversary this October.
What was the first record?
You know, it was some kind of band record they recorded, and they began to borrow masters from other companies, and really for 4 or 5 years up until 1922, they struggled. they were losing money, and they thought about going out of the record business, and suddenly they bought the remains of a label called Black Swan.
Right.
And that was the first 78 record label ever owned by a black man in New York City, Harry Pace. And by 1922, Paramount said, you know, we've got a market out there, we believe, among the black audience, because no one is making records for the black market. So they suddenly started what they called a race series. They didn't want to say Negro. They didn't want to say colored. So what they called it was race music. And they started the Paramount 1200 series. In 1922, it actually lasted until the summer of 1932.
Got so many questions. What was the relationship with Chicago? I think when we were talking about Henry, I remember when I was there before, I heard that some of the artists would come to the area on the Interurban Railroad, you know, take the train up. Talk a little bit about, you and I were talking this week, about, which I don't know much about Marsh Studio. They did Paramount recordings here in Chicago. Talk about Chicago's relationship with the label.
Well, this is it. Chicago was the major, major first market for Paramount's artist. In other words, they're up in Port Washington, just north of Milwaukee. And Orlando Marsh had put a recording studio in around 1921 in Chicago. And by 1922, he's recording, you know, local people who'd come in and pay him. And Paramount rents his studios, and it was in the Kimball Building.
Where's that? I don't know. I know where Lion Healy was, but I don't know where the Kimball was.
I think, I'm not sure. It wasn't on Jackson. One was on Jackson. And the Kimball was Wabash. It was on South Wabash.
Okay. All right. Okay. I like the way you say Wabash. That's good. Totally Southern.
Yeah. Okay. We say Wabash like the Wabash cannonball.
Yeah, right.
That was his first studio, and the L would come by, and, you know, they'd have to stop recording because of the noise of the train. So he moved to the Lion and Healy Building up on the seventh floor, and he had that building. He had primitive recording equipment that was acoustic, and then RCA Victor patented an electrical recording system, and eventually they began to record electrically at Marsh Studios. But Paramount had no equipment of its own, so they simply paid Marsh something like $40 a master, you know, that's for each song, to record their artist there.
This is great stuff. We got to take a break for David Jennings in the news. You can hang on, Gail, right?
Oh, I'll hang on as long as WGN's on air.
That's very good. Very nice of you. And we're going to be back with some more live music with Kathy Greer, so don't go away on our tribute to Paramount Records.
I'd be a fool. I'm just trying to comfort myself, it's true. 'Cause when you're in love with someone like I am with you, what fools do. Well, you always said that it would be me. Right, knew you'd set me free. I'd still take you back in a high. Oh, I'd be a fool. I'd take you back. Break all the rules. I'd still take you back in a high. I'd be a fool. But what fools do.
Very nice. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN 720. That's Kathy Greer. And now that's an original. That's actually on your CD, Studio 330.
Correct.
And that was the song. Tell us about that. Did that help get this award?
I hope so. When I found out that I was going to be in the challenge, I'm not really one for competitions, but I really did want to introduce myself to the Wisconsin blues world. And Chris suggested that I have merchandise, and I didn't. So I went into the local 330 studio in Sturgeon Bay with the wonderful engineer Hans Christian and actually recorded the 30-minute set that I performed for the show.
And now people can get this CD?
You can get it online on my website, KathyGreer.com.
And we were talking about songs before the show. I was asking about how, and maybe Gail, who's on the phone. You still there, Gail?
Yeah, I was just going to note that could have been 1928.
That's what I know.
Paramount recorded a lot of women singers, first with piano, then some with guitar.
Yeah, so both of you can talk about this, but Kathy, how did Paramount Women influence you as a singer?
Oh boy, I started playing guitar back in the 60s, so I heard a lot of old blues things, and certainly Ma Rainey was an influence, Alberta Hunter. When I discovered Geechee Wiley, very deep in terms of a lot of these songs are obviously blues driven by heartbreak and life lessons. I mean, my mama told me just before she died. I mean, these just really deep stories. A lot of people through my life have told me that I'm too folk to be blues, but I've lived a blues life.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
What fools do is that's my own personal story. We've come through these travails. Now, certainly I can never profess to be even close to that, but I certainly can honor it and in the work that I do and the music that I perform and write.
Gail, how where did the label stand in terms of female artists? I mean, were they progressive?
Oh, gosh, it's made its living the first 4 years off just women singers. And like from 1922 to about 26, people like Ma Rainey, Ida Cox, women singers, they were recorded with piano or with a couple of horns behind them. Ma Rainey had massive hits and even led to an off-Broadway show called Ma Rainey's Black Bottom.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful show.
Yeah.
But around 1926, they happened up on a blind blues singer from Dallas, Texas. Took him to Chicago, Blind Lemon Jepson. And he wrote he was a massive seller for Paramount. His records would sell 10 to 50,000 copies. And in those days, in other words, some of his songs like Matchbox Blues came down to Carl Perkins and Rock and Roll.
For sure. Yeah.
And so forth. So, you know, Paramount was recording, the record industry in those days, and it's similar now, they were working off of 1 in 10. And what that meant was you had to have one hit in every 10 releases to pay for the other 9 records. And if you had a hit, you kept on recording more of the same kind of music. So Blind Lemon led to Blind Blake. And Blind Blake had a rag called Wabash Rag. He sang a lot about Chicago. And so, you know, really, and women singers like Geechee Wiley, in other words, they were singing the kind of lifestyle they led.
Mm-hmm.
They were singing about the heartbreak, the troubles they had with men. The men were singing about the problems they had with women. And the blues was really, as they told me, it's a feeling. You know, you get down and you kind of express yourself with a guitar and sing a little bit and play a little bit. And, of course, what Paramount was, they were in the business to make money. So they were constantly looking for new artists, in other words, that would sell. And they were a smaller company, you know, one of the two major smaller companies, but they had Chicago.
Yeah, right.
To look up for a lot of talent.
I want to mention, Kathy, you'll be appearing at noon, tell us on Saturday on the main station?
Yes. Yes, solo.
Solo?
Okay. Yeah.
And Gail, you're coming up and you're going to be lecturing. What are you going to be doing there?
I'm set up for two lectures on Saturday at 10:30 a.m. in the morning in Port Washington. It's the Seven Hill Pubs and Grill. And we'll be playing excerpts of Paramount Records from 1922 to 32. And that's free and open to the public.
Oh, wow.
And on Sunday, yeah, it's open to the public, in other words, because the music will start a little later in the day, I believe around 11, 11:30. Then Sunday I'll be over at Grafton at the Paramount Plaza. And that will be 11 a.m., Paramount Plaza in Grafton. And Grafton is where the actual recording studios were from 1929 to 1932.
And Chris, you want to give us all a little bit more information? Like, is there a website, every day of the festival, hours, admission? Just give me the...
Sure. Right now, people can go to our website, paramountmusic.org. Tickets are available online and will be available online until Friday. Prices, Friday is $10 in advance. Saturday and or Sunday is $25. Prices go up at the gate, so get them online before you come up. We do have some VIP packages available, too, which includes all your drinks and food and all sorts of fun stuff. Mr. Wardlow is right. It is open to the public. The lectures are free. You don't have to attend the festival to come to hear him speak. And I have to tell you from experience, it's quite an experience to hear this man
speak. Oh, he's great.
Speak. Yes.
Gail, can I say Roll Tide to you?
Well, yeah, I was a graduate assistant for Alabama football one time.
You, what were you? What did you do there with Alabama football?
I had a graduate assistantship. I had been a PR man at a small college, and I wanted to get a master's, so I worked for the athletic publicity department writing on Alabama football players, and was considered a graduate assistant in 1973 and 74.
73 and 74, so I can say Roll Tide.
Right, and you know, a great game coming up with Florida State. And listen, one thing I just like to say this: this is the
well,
best.
Want... Go ahead.
This is the best festival, in other words, going on in the country over Labor Day weekend. Regardless of bluegrass, there's some bluegrass festivals, but this is the best blues festival. Everybody out in those 38 states you get out to should be, you know, consider coming.
Well, I know some of this, but I don't know a lot of it. The reason I brought up the football thing was, do you know about Mayo Williams, who was a producer?
Sure.
And I believe he was from Chicago, and he played in the early NFL?
He played college football.
He did.
At a white college, and he came to Chicago and wanted a job, and he got a job with Paramount as a representative, and immediately he started looking for talent, so he was Paramount's really first talent scout in Chicago, and that was his job. And he stayed with them for about 6 years. And
so when would this? I'm fascinated with this. I don't know much about this. When was his period?
1922 to about 1928.
And talent scout, what would he do? Where would he find talent?
He would go places like the Monogram Theater, which was the big black theater, and scout talent. That's where he found Maul Rainey.
Okay.
And he also would go up on Maxwell Street. He found Papa Charlie Jackson, another big seller. And, of course, you know, the word would get out that he was a record scout, so everybody would come to see him. And, you know, he would audition some people he'd make test recordings of. But he was their primary Chicago scout.
Was there competition? I mean, did people want to go to Paramount, or was there competition to go to other labels?
Oh, no, there was major competition. Yeah. You've got the jazz bands from New Orleans, you know, in the early 20s in Chicago, like King Oliver, who had Louis Armstrong on Cornette, and they recorded for Paramount. They also, OK Label.
Oh, yeah, of course.
OK Label in Chicago had a little small studio they recorded in, the Louis Armstrong and Hot 5 Records. Volkswagen put a studio in Chicago by 1926. So you had three or four, you know, major companies. But Paramount did one thing no one else did. They found three scouts in the Deep South, Dallas, Jackson, Mississippi, and Birmingham, to find talent and bring them up and record them. So that's how they got the best talent out of the South.
You know, we're talking here. I think I'm a big shot because I visited there in 2006. But you were there as early as 1969?
Than that. I actually wrote the Chamber of Commerce. I found my first Paramount record in 1961.
Okay.
Door knocking in black neighborhoods, and I was going to swap them.
Where was this at?
Roy Acuff.
Oh, yeah. I know you like the Roy Acuff stuff, yeah.
Yeah. And I started listening to them and loved them. So I kept them. And then I tried to trace some of the history. I found the talent scout in Jackson, Mississippi, that had sent up Charlie Patton and, you know, to Paramount to record. And that led to me writing to Port Washington Chamber of Commerce, like, gosh, 1966, looking for, you know, some of the officers and people who had worked. And so I, you know, tracked down the recording director, Art Labley, up in Park Ridge. And then in 1969, I went up and visited the Preston Room foreman.
That's, yeah, that's the story I heard. Al Schultz?
Yeah, Al Schultz, and he told me about how they recorded. And, you know, one thing about Paramount surprised everybody, but, you know, today if you record, you got 3 hours according to union rules. Mm-hmm. In any, you know, any commercial situation. But in those days, Paramount would bring an artist in, and they'd give him plenty of time to record. If he took all day to do one or two songs, and they were happy, so everything was a lot looser. And it didn't have people lined up behind you, in other words, waiting to come into the studio.
Yeah.
So they got a much better sound, much more relaxed sound, especially on their recordings in Grafton.
It's really great you got those histories down. I mean, you know,
now it's becoming more valuable. The tragedy, Dave, believe it or not, is they kept no ledgers. They were basically a cheap company because they were a chair company. And all their paperwork showing recording dates and all their masters, which were copper masters, were sold off during World War II for junk.
For everybody, why did they go under? Why did they stop?
Well, by the summer of 1932, you know, you had a depression started in the stock market crashed. And by the summer of 32, that was the absolutely worst month of the depression. So they got to the point where they just couldn't sell any records. They were breaking even. So they just simply decided we'll go out of business. And that was around July 1932. And they never went back in the record business. They did some recording for about a year for a Montgomery Ward label. But that was it, and gosh, all the copper masters, including like the Geechee Wiley, Charlie Patton, they were sold off for scrap metal during World War II drives, and all the stock was broken up and sold for shellac for the World War II drive. So back in the 60s, when I started out door knocking, you had to find a Paramount record to know what was on the label, and you never knew, you know, who you would have found another record by.
Did you work, we were talking earlier, I don't know if we had called you yet, did you work with Jack White on any of this stuff when he did his big box set?
I didn't actually work with him, in other words, but I told him if they needed some 78s, I did have some very clean ones, but I did not want to mail them.
Yeah.
You know, they're just too valuable. And hey, let me tell you one other thing, and I think this would be interesting to you. You've heard that expression, all your life probably cutting a record?
Yeah, right.
That came from the fact that back in the 20s, they actually recorded on wax with a diamond needle, and it cut the grooves. So you cut a record before they got tape.
Wow. Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's what the expression, you know, people will still say today, well, we just cut an album or we just cut a record. But everything was cut on wax and then made into a copper master from that. And and again, you know, Paramount was just, it's the most collectible label. And I heard your friend talking about the you know, the albums like vinyls coming back, yeah. And that's true. But there's nothing better than putting on an old 78 with a little scratchy noise with two good speakers and hearing some great blues or jazz from the 1920s.
Right about that. All right, we're going to take a break for some spots, and we'll be back with more on the Paramount record label.
I got a mind to ramble, never work no more. I got a mind to ramble, no work no more. I got a mind to take a chance and gamble everywhere I go. Grapevine's busy, yes, there's talk all over town. Grapevine's so busy, talking all over town. Well, they say the higher that I raise you, the more you try to drag me down. Yeah. Little Alberta Hunter.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal. Kathy, you're great. You should just come and hang out in the studio with us.
Well, I'd love it anytime.
And that was an Alberta Hunter song.
Yeah, yeah.
That was great. And now you're going to be two performances next weekend.
Yes, she's going to be performing at the Paramount Music Festival on Saturday, September 2nd at 12:30. And then she'll also be performing Sunday in Grafton right after the Gail Dean lecture.
Gail, what did you think of her? Gail, you there?
Hey, yeah, I think it's great. I think it's great to be working with her because I'll do the talking and let her do the singing and entertaining.
Deal.
Kathy, in the time, your history is interesting. In the time we have left, so you settled in Sturgeon Bay just when? Just recently?
Yeah, the end of last year. Yeah.
What brought you? You were in New York City. You were a busker from 1999 to 2015.
Yeah, I was.
I read this on your website.
Subway performer, went to Steelbridge Festival in Sturgeon Bay with the beautiful music community of Pat McDonald and Melanie Jane of Purgatory Hill, and this amazing group of songwriters that meet three times a year for a week. And
those guys
fell
are great.
In love.
Is Jackson Brown still involved in that or not?
He was.
He was.
I mean, he's a supporter.
So that's how you found out about the Sturgeon Bay, by going to the Steel Bridge Festival?
Right, and then I was a New York City musician, couldn't afford to live there anymore, so I was looking for someplace new. I was rambling. I wandered around the country, and I went to a lot of different places. And I was in Madison, Wisconsin, at the Badger Bowl. Tony Menzer had a blues night. I joined in. He said, "You need to know what we're doing up in Sturgeon Bay." And I said, "Where's Sturgeon Bay? Never heard of it in my life."
Yeah.
And I mean, it was amazing. So I drove around the country and went back and went to the Steelbridge Festival. And once I moved to Sturgeon Bay, I started looking around and I heard about the Paramount Music Association. And it blew my mind. It was like, this is where it all began, Grafton and the women blues mamas. I was just like, I was in heaven. So
what was it like? This is a little maybe off subject, but what was it like to be a busker? Did you do that the whole time you were there? How long were you? And where did you work?
Well, I performed with the Music Under New York program, and that's a wonderful program that inspires a lot of artists to perform in some of the stations like Grand Central Station, Union Square, Long Island Railroad. I always used to like to say that for a three-hour performance, 10,000 people would pass by me, and the best, absolute best kind of credit I could get is some New Yorker walking by, pulling out an earbud out of their ear, giving me a thumbs up, and continuing to walk on. That's a pretty good shot.
Anyone famous ever walk by you?
No.
Letterman.
I have lots of stories.
Yeah, you
That's
do?
For another time. Yes, I have lots of stories.
Were you working around 9/11?
I was there, yes.
What was that like?
It was tough. It was tough. I felt like the canary in the coal mine. Most of my musician friends, all we wanted to do was get back into the subway to perform. But you have to understand, the stations were filled with posters of people saying missing. And it was just like this horrible experience. But we united in a way that was just brilliant.
For all the panelists, Gail, you're there. One thing you said that resonated, why I wanted to bring that up, Kathy, was you said it kind of created a cultural melting pot. I'm going to try to wrap up the segment. Can you talk about that and how that applies to the blues?
Well, I mean, we've all been listening to music for a really long time, and I love the story of the wax and the needle and cutting records and all that. But I think when you start throwing in the gumbo, I mean, it really is all the different styles. I think of music as being like cooking. What ingredients do I have on my shelf that I could throw in? I like things a little bit spicy. I don't like recipes. I don't want to follow anything. I just go for my heart, and I think that's what makes me feel I'm proud to say I am a blues artist, because it is throwing in all those things that are my personal stories, the stories I hear of other people. As a songwriter, I've learned to listen and pay attention. As a social activist, I care very much about words and how they're said and their context. And I think that's what's beautiful having a blues festival like this is to be able to share the live music, because as we know, artists don't make their money on recordings anymore.
Mm-hmm, right. And real briefly, Gail, can you elaborate on that?
No, I just say, I mean, it's fantastic. That's the kind of music you're going to hear if you come to the festival. And you can't just hear it every place every day. And what I especially like about her music is she plays the guitar. In other words, you got guitar blues. And that most people are playing electric, you know, guitars these days at blues festivals.
Well, thank you, Gail. Do you go over to the Floribama Lounge? You ever been over there? They got music there.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, golly, yeah.
We'll have to meet there for a beer, Gail.
I'll meet you there one day.
I love that place. They got a lot of great music. Chris Raymond, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Wrap up the festival again. Let's plug
it. Well, you just said beer. We'll have 72 varieties of beer at the festival. So come
Dan
on
Wong.
Up. Thanks for having us.
72 varieties?
72
varieties. What's the regional? Is there a local beer for Port Washington?
Well, not Port Washington, but we're trying to include as many breweries as we can, obviously, and that's what we're doing.
And give me the days of the festival again and the website again.
September 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. That's this coming weekend, Labor Day weekend. The website is paramountmusic.org.
This is going to be a wonderful event. So I've been there. It's a great city, great area. So
I will have an electric guitar.
Okay.
Sorry.
All right. Thanks, Gail.
Thanks, Gail.
Okay.
Thanks, Gail.
And thank you all for listening to Nocturnal Journal tonight. Thanks to Dan Long, Brett Jackson, Krista Flores, and John Saul for the audio from Springfield, Missouri. We'll see you next week.